The following Dharma talk was given by monastic Shoan Ankele at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan is a Dharma holder in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is given free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody at home. Oh, wow, what an experience, right? I was thinking last night, if you were going to, if let's just say you were born in a human body and then were reporting back to some like non, and they didn't have like a reference point for feelings, and you were like trying to explain like that aspect of being a person, like, yeah, well, there's like so many feelings. And you were trying to explain like what is a feeling to, you know, it's like that mind expanding thought experiment that I remember engaging in as a like third grader, where it's like, wait, I know what the taste of broccoli is, but like, how do we know that broccoli doesn't taste like chocolate to you? Like, we'll never figure it out. Like, what does broccoli actually taste like? You know? No. Like how you can't get inside someone else's experience, and yet our experience is so like vivid to us. It's so like consuming to us. And so feelings, like if you were to say like, well, there, it's like what? It's like this like quality, this experience, this like state that kind of like gets triggered and comes in and like takes you over and lasts for a while. And like while you're having that feeling, like everything you see is like through that lens. And then I was imagining this like other being would be like, wow, that sounds like so intense. I'd be like, yes! Being a person is so intense. And then they might be like, so like, how many feelings do you have like in a lifetime, in a day, certainly in a session, depending, you know, I know we're all different. Not everyone's like, maybe relates to that so much. Anyway, onward. So speaking of feelings, I've been thinking about vulnerability once again, and just what a doorway it is. So I will pick that up in a moment or two, but first, just that chant that we chant at the start of the day, monastics putting on our kesa, Jukai students putting on the raksu, all of us chanting together, vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. I wear the Tathagata's teaching, saving all sentient beings. And sometimes vast is the robe of liberation, and I think about like the night sky and how vast, like that's as vast as anything I know. And sometimes I think about like that when we hold the kesa out to put it on, like that vast, I think like, oh, it's like wrapping myself in a piece of that night sky. And this formless field of benefaction. What is that? I wear the Tathagata's teaching, saving all sentient beings. That's where the feelings came in. I was thinking about sentient beings. Sentient. Beings who can perceive and feel. So we are on a journey. I'm on a journey. You are too. As a community, as a Sangha, we're on a collective journey. As a human species, we're on a collective journey. But I come back to thinking about that again and again because it's what my life is teaching me. It's what my life is showing me. Like, oh, it's a journey. And if we can engage our life as a spiritual journey, then it can become an unfolding of understanding, of growth and transformation, of connection and healing, of becoming more and more completely ourselves, whoever that is, whoever that turns out to be, at ease in our own experience, at ease in this human body, and knowing more and more deeply who we are, really. But it's not a straight line journey. Not in my experience, not at all. And sometimes I can have the perspective of appreciating the beauty of the branches and the twisting, even the tangles. And sometimes it's just hard. It's just rough. But to use this time as a person, it goes so fast, right? It goes so fast. Wow. Yeah. So fleeting. So to use it to deepen our understanding, to deepen in our connection, in our manifestation of love. We have a shorthand for that within Zen. We speak about encountering Buddha mind, liberation, words we could attach a lot to. But as I was thinking about that vast robe and that formless field, I thought, oh, what are they made of? I thought, vulnerability. Vulnerability and faith and vow. So I wanted to say a little bit more. It's all held by love. And that's another word, which I guess I'm using it to mean wholeness and acceptance and fundamental, unshakable, intrinsic, complete belonging, connection, one whole thing, unity. That's how I'm using love. So our vulnerability often is what brings us in the door to practice. If you think about your own situation, some flavor of pain or suffering, even if it's more of the confusion or bewilderment or dissatisfaction variety, that's typically what brings us in. And what keeps us? What keeps us, if not on a Zen path, on a path? Faith. And like, what makes the whole thing shift and change? Vow. So to begin with, I said, you know, it's all held by love. It's all held by wholeness, acceptance, belonging, connection, irrefutable unity. And, you know, we can look around the world and think like, yeah, I'm not seeing that. But if you temporarily remove the endless complications of the human realm, and just like take another look, like, wow, wow, you know, during this the recent COVID outbreak, Gokhan and I were sick in our cabin and discovered that we had the BBC Life series, where it goes into the different animal realms. There's like a whole section on insects and birds and amphibians. It's amazing. And I just want to say, first of all, this is kind of, it may seem unrelated, but we're doing an earth body practice this Ango. So you can just frame it in those terms. But this is just to illustrate the, like, for sure held in love principle, okay? So there is this fish that is called the sarcastic fringe fish. Yes, somebody named it that. And when you see this, you're like, oh my God, Jim Henson for sure saw this fish because it looks exactly like a Muppet. It's like, is this thing for real? And it's David Attenborough doing the voiceover, and he's just so brilliant at it. And so he's talking about how, like, the sarcastic fringe fish, like, has to be very territorial and, like, defend its territory. And so that makes it grumpy a lot because, like, the ocean's crowded and there's always, like, these other creatures that are trying to come into its territory. And it shows, it, they tend to live in abandoned shells. So there's this, like, big conch shell or something. And then it shows this sarcastic fringe fish sticking its head out, and it's got these two eyes and then this big, big mouth, and it's like looking around at the bottom of the ocean, and then things kind of swim by and it like opens its mouth in a threatening way. And then it says, okay, so all's well and good, but like watch out if another sarcastic fringe fish appears on the scene. And lo and behold, they have this incredible footage. So this other sarcastic fringe fish appears on the scene with its like googly eyes and its like big mouth, and they show them like sizing each other up. And it's like David Attenborough's like, one of them will have to go. This can't be good, you know, like this. And they come together, and then their mouths open, and their mouths kind of like dislocate, so they become gigantic. Like imagine if like my mouth, I started to open it and then it grew to be the size of bigger than my whole body. It's like that, like I was like, whoa. And then out came this big mouth, and then imagine that Seiryu here is my other sarcastic fringe fish. And he opens his mouth, and now his mouth is bigger than his whole body. And now we're like coming at each other with our giant mouths open, and our mouths actually lock. And we're like in this thing where we're like battling for territory with our mouths open, like locked, like it is crazy. Amazing. I have like a few more, but I'm not going to blow all of my time telling you. I'm just going to tell you the one that's an exotic one because that's at the bottom of the ocean. This is like our squirrels, our gray squirrels. So they show this squirrel, just like the guys, you just saw one on your way, you know, after rest practice walking around. This one squirrel has found, and I guess this is a behavior that's a repeated behavior. It's not just like this one did it. Finds this rattlesnake skin that the rattlesnake has like sloughed off, and I don't know if I said that right. Is it slough or is it slough? Slough. Thank you. Rattlesnake skin, and it shows this like squirrel is like nibbling it and like rubbing it all over itself, and David Attenborough's like, this strange behavior, this squirrel is taking the rattlesnake skin and rubbing it on itself so it will smell like rattlesnake. And then a rattlesnake comes close to the squirrel's den, and this squirrel is like, gets right down by the rattlesnake, like just short, like if Saber you were the rattlesnake, I would be the squirrel. And so the squirrel gets down there and it like puffs up its tail. And David Attenborough's like, and its tail makes it look bigger than it actually is. And it puffs up its tail and it's flicking its tail like this. I'm thinking it looks kind of like a rattlesnake, you know, I don't know. Anyway, it's flicking its tail back and forth, and the scent and the size confuse the rattlesnake, and the rattlesnake like slithers away. And the squirrel has like beaten, outsmarted the rattlesnake. Just a humble gray squirrel. So, I believe I was making the point about the perfect universe of which you are an inexorable part. And I could go on, but I'll leave it at that. So this is to underscore the trustworthiness, the fundamental trustworthiness, not of the human realm, because we were confused, really confused, but of the universe, of like the earth. My mother will sometimes say, you know, in such a universe where there are like humpback whales and like gorillas and like so much magic, like how can death be such a scary, menacing, bad thing? You know, and my mother is 80, so she's like speaking from a particular view, although she's been saying that for many years. Meaning like we may be afraid, but that's kind of on us. Actually, if we look around, the signs are very good. So our vulnerability, our human sentience makes us feel all kinds of things. These can be difficult feelings, and at the same time, isn't this what brings us in the door? So there is an importance to our suffering. Thich Nhat Hanh says, no mud, no lotus, right? If we make that personal without our own share of difficulty and pain, would we be embarking on a path of waking up? That's why the human realm is considered so auspicious. Because if you're born in the God realm, life is so good, you don't do anything to actually liberate yourself. That vulnerability is a gate. We can recognize our affliction. We can recognize our kleshas and then try to use them. So there has to be a wakeful relationship with our feeling world. We have to recognize what's going on. And then whatever's going on, we like let it in. So this is the vastness of that robe. Nothing's left out. And so we should notice for ourselves, what are the things that we cast out? Is it a feeling? Is it a thing or a being? Is it a moment? This is a waste of time. So we fade out, turn away. And then what happens? This is what we see again and again in a practice like Zazen, where the vulnerability is always there. It's just, are we present to it? And the turning away is there a whole lot. Are we present to it? And then the practice of turning toward, bringing that cast out thing, that moment, that thought, that feeling, that part of ourselves, bringing it in close, close, close. And when we bring it in close, that's the vastness. And that's the field of benefaction. It's hard. It's hard to do that. It's hard to do that because we're habitually distracted. It's hard to do that because we don't like to be uncomfortable. So that's why we're training ourselves. And it's both like so personal, so specific. Our feeling states, our habits, they arise from the causes and conditions of our own life. And it's like way beyond personal. Both things are true. And sometimes we can feel that our present difficulty, our suffering, our pain, our difficult feelings are a personal failure. And I mean, there are aspects of the dominant culture that really reinforce that. I'm sorry, I am so like sick of even just like the slightest waft of this like curated life stuff that I'm not on any social media, but just the whole like the little snippets that I see, I'm just like, wow, this is so dangerous. Nobody's out there having the perfect life. And that is so not what this experience is about. This human experience. Don't be fooled. We can have a larger view. And part of this larger view, this like very, the Dharma is like, you can like take a few spoonfuls and it will give you sustenance for the road. But if you like want to have the whole meal, fasten your seatbelt. That's sort of awkward mixed metaphors. Pull up your chair, tuck in your napkin, I don't know. Yeah, get ready for some serious flavors, I don't know. There's a teaching that this life as we experience it is like a dream. That all of the highs and the lows and the pain and the joy and the grasping and the aversion, all of it, we're making up. And that metaphor is used again and again in the teachings that, like, you know, like this waking experience that we take for granted, this sense of myself being in my life and having this thing happen to me, like all of that is like a view from within a clouded, I don't know, it's like a dream. It's like a dream. And we can think, the teachings will say, like, well, so you can think like, how is that? It is not like a dream. Here I am, there you are, this is real, this is happening. Yeah, okay. And when you're in a dream asleep, like think of a vivid dream that you remember, it's so real. Last week, I went to bed early because I'm trying to get some extra rest so I get all the way better from COVID. And so I went to bed early. And when Gokhan came into the cabin, it woke me up. And I had been in the middle of this like very upsetting dream where there was a small child buckled into a high chair safety seat, choking. And I was trying to undo the thing to get the baby out, to turn it upside down, because I knew that's what needed to happen. And I couldn't undo the thing, and the baby was choking. I couldn't undo the thing, and the baby was choking. Gokhan came in, and I woke up. And I said, oh my God, I was just having the most terrible dream. And you know how you, like, if you've ever, like, told someone a dream while you're still sort of in it. And so I was, like, telling the dream, and there was this baby, and I tried to get the baby up, and I couldn't get it up, and I started crying. I was in a vulnerable state. Alexa is getting better from COVID, and I went to bed early and I was feeling kind of sick. So like all of those things were compounded. So I'm like telling him the thing about the baby and I couldn't unbuckle it and I start like sobbing. And Gokhan said, "It's okay. It's okay. It was just a dream." And in that moment, it was like I knew that it was a dream, but I had carried the feeling with me, and I felt that the feeling was still real. And when I heard him say, "It's okay, it's okay," I thought, wait, I was still in my kind of my whimpers, and I thought, wait, he's talking to me from another place. Like I could tell from his tone, like nothing sad was happening. And so I saw it dissolve, and I'd been reading these Madhyamaka teachings about the dream thing. So I'm like lying there in my bed and I like see the whole thing dissolve. And I'm thinking like, oh, this is what they say. They say that life is like this. And then I started laughing. Yeah, it was trippy. Which brings me to faith. So there is a need to release our hold on this path. And we encounter that right away. It's right there in the first instruction that we get. We're going to encounter all kinds of thoughts and feelings in our mind rather than sit there and pursue them. Teach yourself what it means to let them pass through, to not run after, to not hop on the train, to let it go. We have to learn how to do that. And we have to learn how to do that, not just when we're in Zazen, but then when we're in the midst of our life. And we can keep learning. We can keep deepening our understanding of what it means to let go, to not hold on. We can keep deepening our understanding of that until we can start to actually see the dream, because that's made from our holding on at a very subtle level. So more and more subtle, this release, as we see more and more how subtle the holding on is. And so with this release, our sense of our own vulnerability begins to shift. Thich Nhat Hanh has a very beautiful passage where he talks about, he compares it to like sitting on the riverbank, watching the flow of the river. Not distant, not cold, but we're no longer like drowning, needing a branch or an inner tube. Still, there's the rush, there's the spray, there's the sound, there's the beauty, but we're not threatened. Our life isn't at stake. And faith and then that holding love work together so closely. It's like the warp and the woof of the fabric in that robe of liberation. And that faith can keep deepening and deepening and deepening. If we have an insight or a sense about emptiness, what does it mean to cultivate faith in that insight? That trust in the love and the holding can deepen and deepen. And Zazen, can we sit here and just be in the field of benefaction? That is where we reside. Can we release our hold to see that? That is our Zazen practice. I was thinking about the different sutras where the nuns are confronted by Mara, that is part of the Ango reading, and how that can be a really useful way of appreciating those voices that come into our mind and shake our confidence make us feel we're not worthy, sow the seeds of doubt about our own practice or ability to realize ourselves. The voices also that distract, that lure us with like, oh, wouldn't you rather be doing such and such? I mean, all of those, when you look at those teachings, those are the different things the nuns are confronting. And they all say the same thing, I see you, Mara, to recognize what's happening. When we recognize it, we're not in the river anymore, grasping for a branch. We've gotten on the bank. I see you. So vow. Gokhan has quoted Shahaku Akamura before, who says that as practitioners, the shift is to live by vow, not by karma, right? Normally, we're just reacting in our habitual ways that we've learned, that have been handed down, but we can turn that. That's vow. So vow may sound like a lofty word, and maybe for me, for many years, it felt so religious. Now I like that. But it's about intention, and there's a discipline to it. There's a discipline to it. When we take our seat, there is a quality of vow that we are embodying. Certainly, if you can't get on board with vow, certainly intention, right? To be with our experience, to not turn away. We say sit still so that we have this really concrete reminder. Otherwise, we're out. Sit still, be with your experience. That's how you're going to transform it. So instead of our habit, instead of our karma, we come back to that intention, that commitment. And a vow is made, but then it's actually made moment to moment to moment. We have to return to it again and again. Abolitionist activist Miriam Kaba says, hope is a discipline, which is a quote that I encountered on the yard sign of some Dharma sisters in the neighborhood, and it really stayed with me. And I read a bit about what Miriam Kaba had to say about that. She was asked in an interview, and she said, well, it's work to be hopeful, right, in this present age. It's work to be hopeful. It's not like a fuzzy feeling. You actually have to put in energy, time, and you have to be clear-eyed, and you have to hold fast to having a vision. It's a hard thing to maintain, but it matters to have it, to believe that it's possible to change the world. You know, we don't live in a predetermined, predestined world where nothing we do has an impact. No. No, that's not true. Change is, in fact, constant, right? She says, we're constantly changing. We're constantly transforming. Vow is seeing the truth of that and then using that. Using that. How are we giving our energy? What are we giving it to? How are we using our time, even just on the cushion? When we see ourselves repeating patterns of denigration or getting stuck in old loops, you cannot cut it off. Aggression does not work. Even if you manage to for a moment, it will come back in some other form. So you have to turn toward. You have to go to what's underneath. Bring it in close. Hold it in your own spacious field, your own heart, your own love. That's where the alchemy happens. So, we have this practice. We are held in love. You find your way to it through yourself, through softening your own heart, cultivating your own faith. Fiercely embodying your own vow. It might seem personal, but it is much, 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 much bigger. But lucky us, we just have to work right here, right now.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.